I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and welcome to Health Matters on Red River Radio. You know, despite government regulation, massive public education, and the widespread availability of recovery programs, alcoholism remains a significant public health problem. And that will be the topic of tonight's discussion on Health Matters on member-supported Red River Radio. This is a live show, and you can call us with your questions or comments. The number is 1-800-552-8502. We have three excellent guests with us tonight. We have Dr. Paul Wilson, an internal medicine specialist here in Shreveport with Willis-Knighton Health System, and also the medical director for the Council for Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. We also have Mr. Bill Rose, the executive director of the Council for Alcohol and Drug Abuse of Northwest Louisiana. And we have an anonymous guest tonight. Her name is Judy, and she is the wife of a recovering alcoholic. Again, this is Health Matters on Red River Radio. I'm your host tonight, Dr. Randall Brewer, and this is a live show, and you can call us at 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet us a question at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Wilson, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So what is actually the definition of alcoholism, and what are some of the medical issues that can pertain to the use of alcohol?
There's quite a few different definitions of alcoholism out there. The one that I tend to use is a very simple one that I think is very practical. And the definition I use is alcoholism is the continued consumption of alcohol in the face of compelling reasons to discontinue use. And I've got a couple of examples that I can make about that. You'll notice that definition doesn't speak specifically to any specific quantity or frequency of use. I had a friend who was a heavy drinker for years. I considered him to be an alcoholic, although I didn't know that. And a few years ago, he got a DUI. And after that happened, he stopped drinking. There it was, a compelling reason to discontinue the use. He did. Not an alcoholic. I had another acquaintance who probably drank less than the first person, but it seemed like every time he drank, he got in trouble. He accumulated a string of DUIs, ended up going to jail. And again, even though he probably drank less and probably less frequently than the first person, clearly an alcoholic in his case.
So continued use despite harmful consequences.
Correct.
That's going to be your bottom line definition for a problem with alcohol.
Correct.
Very good. Bill, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
So you've been associated with the Council for Alcoholism and Drug Abuse for quite some time, and we were talking earlier before the show started. Can you share with us a little bit about what brought you into the field?
Well, I have been working for the Council on Alcoholism now for about 16 years. Actually, this is my second time working for this organization. I originally started, I think, sometime around 1990. Prior to that, I worked for several local for-profit hospitals, Doctors Hospital, Southwest Medical Center, a number of addiction providers in Shreveport-Bossier area. What brought me to this work in addiction is I'm a recovering alcoholic. Went through a doctor's hospital inpatient unit, which was about 28 days. Got involved after I completed a inpatient program and participated in aftercare program, and for about 2 years after treatment, I had an opportunity 6 months into my recovery to do a weekend aftercare group. You know, there were clients that were, or patients at the time that had completed an inpatient program, and they would do follow-up therapy once a week. And I had an opportunity to work with those guys part-time, and about 6 months later, I had an opportunity to go to work in substance abuse treatment full-time. So I've been doing this type of work since then.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us. Judy, thank you for coming tonight.
I'm glad to be here.
So share with us a little bit about your story, what alcoholism has meant to you.
Well, my husband is a recovering alcoholic, and he's got some long-time recovery now, but at the point in time when he was still drinking, it had a big impact on our family, and I was not very educated about it. I didn't know very much about alcoholism. So what I noticed was financial impact, emotional impact, and obviously marital problems that issued from that particular drinking issue.
Thank you so much. It takes a lot of courage to talk about these issues, I'm sure, and we really appreciate you being on tonight.
Thank you.
This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. I'm your host. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. The number here for your questions or comments, 1-800-552-8502, or you can submit a question via Twitter at RRR Public Radio. Bill, you mentioned that it was a 28-day program that you're associated with. And so if someone, let's say, someone such as the individual Dr. Wilson was speaking of, let's say they've had an arrest and they've said, well, I don't think I can do this on my own. How do they find such a treatment program, and what does that program actually look like?
Well, actually, the Council on Alcoholism, for example, offers a full continuum of care, which actually begins with outpatient services. We have which is the least restrictive level of care. You know, from time to time, we'll have someone that may have an incident, you know, maybe out at the at a restaurant or nightclub that may have one or two drinks, get into a vehicle, get pulled over, and get arrested for DUI or DWI. And they may not necessarily have the symptoms of someone that we consider alcohol dependent. So we can provide, educational-based or early intervention types of programs at the outpatient clinic. You know, on the far end or the far extreme of the levels of care that we provide, we have a residential facility in Bossier City called Cato Bossier Treatment Center, where we actually provide four different levels of care. One is detox. It's a medically assisted detox program that lasts anywhere from 5 to 7 days. Depends on the severity of their addiction and their potential for withdrawal. We also provide a high intensity residential program, which is pretty equivalent to the 28-day program that I attended almost 27 years ago. And this is typically someone that, there's a process that we use during admission to determine the appropriateness and eligibility based upon that level of care, which is primarily decided by insurance companies. You know, insurance decides that, because we're just like the for-profit sector, we deal with utilization review providers, whether they're an insurance client or they're receiving services based upon state funding. So there's usually some medical necessity that dictates whether they're appropriate for detox, high intensity residential, and then they have the option if there's a need, and it's usually something related to whether their environment, it's high risk for relapse. If they have an appropriate place to return to post-discharge, whether they have vocational needs to determine whether they meet criteria for the low-intensity residential program. And the other one is basically a family program that we offer at Bossier for pregnant women or women with children. So the full continuum of care, and also one has to do is to make a call and to any of the numbers at the Council on Alcoholism. And the first step is to do an intake, and the assessment process is going to dictate which program is going to be more appropriate for their need.
This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. I'm your host tonight, Dr. Randall Brewer. Our number for your questions or comments is 1-800-552-8502. Our guest tonight, Dr. Paul Wilson, the medical director of the Council for Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, Mr. Bill Rose. the Executive Director for the Council for Alcohol and Drug Abuse Northwest Louisiana, and Judy, the wife of a recovering alcoholic. Dr. Wilson, you mentioned that there could be harmful effects from alcoholism, obviously on the social spectrum. What about medically? Does it harm your body to drink over a long period of time?
Absolutely, and that, unlike the definition of alcoholism, that does have a direct correlation with the amount that you take in. There's actually three real medical effects of alcohol. There's the immediate effects when you drink, which cause loss of inhibition, loss of or decrease in your reflexes, some decrease in your judgment, and again that's directly correlated to the amount that you drink. And then when you continue to drink, you get into other types of more long-lasting health issues like scarring of the liver, which is called cirrhosis. It can cause damage to your heart, damage to the nervous system, dementia, things of that nature. And another thing that we frequently see in alcoholics who have been drinking for a long time are health issues related to not taking care of themselves because of their drinking. A lot of times alcoholics will, if they have to choose between food and alcohol, they'll choose alcohol. And, so we see a lot of malnutrition, of course, along with the social implications, there's people lose their jobs, they end up on the streets, and you get a whole host of health issues related to that as well.
What is the amount is it known what amount is actually required over one's lifetime to produce cirrhosis or to produce, alcoholic cardiomyopathy or to produce dementia? Are those numbers known?
I don't think they have actual numbers for that. It's quite variable. The current evidence suggests that if an individual limits their alcohol consumption to two portions of alcohol a day, and that can be two beers, two glasses of wine, or two jiggers of hard liquor, there is some evidence to suggest that there are some health benefits to that. Now, I don't recommend that my patients that don't drink take it up, but for patients that do drink, if they remain within those parameters, I think that's probably okay.
Very good. This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Randall Brewer. Our number for calls, it's 1-800-552-8502. Judy, you're the wife of a recovering alcoholic, and you mentioned some of the effects on the family.
Mm-hmm.
And this is known it's a family illness, isn't it?
It is. And one of the things that was really helpful to me early on, I'm a longtime Al-Anon member, and Al-Anon is a 12-step program for the families of people who are, or it's really for people who are affected by alcoholism. You might have a spouse or a child or a parent or a sibling, but I came into Al-Anon originally to try to figure out how to stop my husband from drinking because I knew that they must have the answer. They must have the magic pill. But I quickly realized, and Al-Anon teaches us, that we stay for ourselves. So fortunately, I just stuck around long enough to start listening to the message that we can't control the alcoholic or the addict in our lives, but we can control ourselves. So for me, the program of Al-Anon was really very significant because it taught me to start focusing on my attitude and what I could control. And over time, it helped me see how really crazy my behavior had become too.
Yeah, I think a lot is written and talked about in situations where someone's trying to control an alcoholic and they're hiding their liquor and they're trying to get them to stop drinking at home, but when there are consequences, they're bailing them out of jail, they're calling their boss and saying that they're
right.
Sick and things along those lines. So it can become its own disease, huh?
Well, and for me, I can only speak for myself, but for me, I realized I had become just as insane in trying to, not just to control this drinking, but also to, I tried everything. I tried to manipulate by being really nice and enabling, or I tried being angry, or I tried being upset, and none of that was working. And I looked back and realized, you know, I had become really crazy in trying to manipulate and control all of this. And when I started focusing on myself and what I could change about my attitude, and I relaxed my grip a little bit, he was ironically kind of free to seek the help that he needed, and that is what happened. He got help.
Very good. And you mentioned the program is Al-Anon, and that's the companion program, if you will, to Alcoholics Anonymous, correct?
It is a similar 12-step program. We use the same 12 steps that Alcoholics Anonymous does.
And so there are meetings that are held within the community, and groups of people meet and talk about the issues.
Right. Okay. We all have that one common bond, and we share our own stories of recovery. We don't come in to talk about what to do about the alcoholics and addicts in our lives. We share our own stories of personal recovery, and it's very supportive and very helpful, and anyone who might be interested can Google Al-Anon and find local meetings in our area.
Very good. This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. Our topic tonight is alcoholism. We have three guests. We have Dr. Paul Wilson, the medical director for the Council for Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. We have Mr. Bill Rose, who is the executive director there, and Judy, the wife of a recovering alcoholic. Mr. Rose, do you provide the patients or the clients access to Alcoholics Anonymous in your program?
Right, we do. In fact, we don't, as part of our treatment program, provide Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, but we do allow the community to bring in outside meetings. In fact, there's a couple of groups called hospital and institution groups, which are connected to either AA or Narcotics Anonymous. It brings meetings to our facility. And about 3 to 4 times a week, we take our clients out to AA meetings in the community as well.
And I understand that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous invites individuals to have what's called maybe a sponsor or a program buddies in the program where they can really connect even outside of the meeting. Is that something that you see as helpful?
They do. In fact, one of the groups that come into our facility, it's called Bridge the Gap, which is part of, I think, their Hospitals and Institutions Committee of AA, come into the facility, and several things that they do. One is to make access to our clients, potential AA sponsors. The other thing is to bring to them what's called step study groups, or groups that really study the basic texts of AA within the facility. So they get to meet people that they keep a connection with, a relationship after they get out of treatment, which becomes sponsors, or they get one from people that come in to bring those type of groups in the facility.
Very good. Dr. Wilson, we have a few questions coming in. One question that was asked was, is there such a thing as a functioning alcoholic, and how does one get one of those individuals into treatment? And perhaps maybe it's someone who's only having consequences that are not really seen outside of the home.
There absolutely is a functional alcoholic. There's probably a lot of them walking around out there. One of the last things that tends to go in an alcoholic's life is his job. And the reason for that is because that's the source of his money, and that's the way he gets his alcohol. So a lot of alcoholics, you know, their marriage will go, they'll have legal problems, but they're able to keep that job going in order to continue with what they're doing. As far as how to reach those people, that's a difficult question. Until someone has a consequence that makes them at least be open to receiving help, there's really not much that you can do for them.
So they have to have some consequence that brings to light that I really have a problem with this.
Right. And it can be any number of things. You know, I suppose it could be someone just wakes up one day and says, I'm tired of drinking. I have not seen that happen myself very often.
Judy, another question was submitted. The listener is asking, is there a program for young adults or teens who may have family members that are affected by alcoholism that's similar to Al-Anon?
Yes, I'm really glad the caller asked that question, because there's a program called Al-Ateen, and that is specifically for younger people and teenagers. And I know we have some very active Al-Ateen programs in this community. I was also going to tell Paul that one thing my husband likes to say is, nobody just walks up to an AA group and says, hey, you look like a fun group of guys, I'd like to join. It's usually because you've had something happen in your life.
But it seems to me like that would be a really good situation for maybe, anyone who thinks that they could potentially have a problem. Is it possible to go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and sit and listen, even if they don't know if they have a problem with alcoholism?
Well, and I'll answer that. In fact, someone told me a long time ago, early in my personal recovery, I think in July, it will be 27 years I've been sober.
Congratulations.
That normal people don't sit around wondering whether they have a problem with alcohol. it's just not something you do. Most of the people that we see either in treatment and in most cases in 12-step programs usually have some sort of consequence that drives them to treatment. Now, we deal with individuals that may have mild, moderate, or severe issues with alcoholism. And some people come in with real mild issues that may, I think Paul talked about issues related to family. Usually if you're in a relationship with someone that's drinking excessively, or it interferes with, the relationship at some level, there's going to be some problems within that system. And they may continue to keep their job and do other things, but it creates a problem. Most of the folks that we see, especially at the residential program, are typically somewhere between the moderate to severe level of alcoholism. We treat a lot of the folks that have a mild issue with substance use disorders at the outpatient clinic. But functional alcoholics, some people function very well, although they may fall in that real chronic area of addiction. It varies. You'll have people that can sit and have three or four beers and just totally unable to function. Where you may have a guy that can drink 16 beers and function, get up and go to work and do the things, although he may begin to have health issues or family problems or even financial difficulties.
Thank you very much. We have another question that was the questions tend to be anonymous tonight, which is in keeping with the recovery principles. This question was called in. The wife of an alcoholic who is now 59, but an alcoholic since he was 17. He is now in prison for an alcohol-related incident, and apparently the prison will provide some basic alcohol recovery. But the wife thinks that he has some childhood issues that need to be worked on. How can she get them to help him while he's in prison with some of these, more deeper counseling issues?
So I'll just jump in to say that, one of the things Al-Anon teaches spouses or significant others is you can't control that other person. And so to be able to go to the prison and to say, I think this is the issue and I think he needs this help, that is where it's probably more constructive and helpful to start helping yourself and trusting that this person is in the hands of, in my opinion, a higher power, which is a tenet of the 12 steps, and to focus on herself and what she can do to make her own life more productive and happier, and not try to intervene.
Unfortunately, most prisons don't have programs that address substance use disorders. You know, a lot of them have available 12-step meetings. You know, in this community, there's programs within the parish prison system as well as AA meetings, but that's not real typical of prison systems. I would say if there are available programs, that that inmate, and I don't know what kind of influence the family would have to encourage them to participate, but there are some sort of programs that they can access at some level in prison. Don't know how much therapy that's being offered in the criminal justice setting. So, you know, the problem is that there's a huge population of folks that are in the criminal justice system that actually continue to use alcohol or other substances once they come out because of the unavailable programs. So, you know, I think, you know, there are reentry programs that are available that can refer them to counseling once they're released. But if there are ones in the system itself, then they should try to access those programs.
I think she makes an excellent point, though. As a healthcare professional, it's crucial that other illnesses, I mean, we see a lot of alcoholics with depression, with bipolar disorder, with issues like that, that the chance of a successful recovery is greatly improved if these are addressed as well.
Yeah, that seems like that's a very common scenario, that folks who do have problems with alcoholism do have a comorbid, if you will, you know, mental health disorder, depression, anxiety disorders, bipolar disorder. You know, the issue of maybe some childhood trauma was brought up with that question. Do you see that alcoholism tends to be an inherited phenomenon?
There's clearly a hereditary link. As with a lot of things, I think it's a combination of environment and heredity, but the studies are pretty clear on that. If you're a family member of an alcoholic, then your chances of being an alcoholic are greater than if that's not the case.
And, you know, apparently if a parent's an alcoholic, then the child is being exposed to alcohol in the family very early on, so there's obviously an environmental component very early, and then the hereditary issue, I think, is very important for us to, you know, to consider as well.
Right. Interestingly, most or a large number of alcoholic children end up either being alcoholics themselves or teetotalers, much higher than in the population of people that are not, you know, that do not grow up in an alcoholic home.
Interesting. So they sort of either abstain altogether or they become an alcoholic and not very much middle ground.
Right.
This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. I'm your host tonight, Dr. Randall Brewer. The topic is alcoholism. We have three guests with us tonight. We have Dr. Paul Wilson, the medical director for the Council for Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, as well as the executive director there, Mr. Bill Rose, and the wife of a recovering alcoholic, Judy. In terms of the demographics of alcoholism, Bill, do you see that alcoholism is becoming more prevalent, or have the numbers somewhat stabilized?
Well, alcohol is always going to be the number one substance of abuse that we're going to treat at the, whether it's residential or outpatient level. You know, what we're seeing, because there are trends that change from time to time. You know, back in the early to late 80s, we were fighting the cocaine or crack cocaine addiction. You know, we've seen methamphetamine sweep through this community, especially in the rural areas. But the things that we're seeing in addition to alcohol is going to be the abuse or dependency on the narcotic pain medication, and also marijuana. You know, primarily marijuana with the younger population, but the young adults as well as the older adults or increasingly using narcotic pain medication. I do have a theory, and I haven't done research, but you know, I realize that you know, this baby boomer population is an aging population. In fact, I was born in the last year of the baby boomers, and I'll be 51 this year. And lots of folks, for whatever reason, were needing narcotic pain medication. And for us in the treatment industry, the DEA is making it a little more difficult to get access to legitimate prescriptions for medications. So a lot of those folks that have gotten hooked on those sort of legitimate prescriptions for pain medication are now using heroin. It's accessible, it's cheap, and we didn't have a heroin problem in Shreveport a year ago, but we're now treating folks for addictions to heroin because they can't get prescriptions anymore, or they're having a difficult time getting prescriptions. Plus, heroin is a little bit cheaper than buying hydrocodone out on the street.
It's interesting, sort of like Prohibition didn't stop drinking, did it?
No, it didn't.
It just made it more glamorous.
It didn't stop drinking, and of course, when they ended Prohibition, alcohol became readily available for folks that normally were not exposed to alcohol. You know, we can see in some of the, well, we don't have counties here in Louisiana, but dry parishes. You know, once you introduce a substance to the parish, people that didn't have access to it sometimes develop problems, just like gambling.
We have a caller. We have Bill from Texas. Bill, thank you for calling tonight.
Hi. I guess I'm calling because I'd like to ask a couple of questions. You know, I've had some substance abuse problems. I've kicked methamphetamines. I've kicked cocaine. Kicked smoking. And seems like the more I give up, you know, seems like my drinking picks up a little all the time. And I'm just kind of wondering, you know, there was a time when alcohol caused a lot of problems in my life, but it seems like now I'm not, you know, it's not really causing me any problems per se, but I feel like I'm drinking more. Should I be worried about my alcohol, you know, bearing in mind that I've given up so many other bad habits, or should I feel kind of lost, really.
This is Dr. Wilson. There's the a condition called cross-addiction, which says that if you've lost control of your ability to handle one mood-altering substance, that it's unlikely that you'll ever be able to use another mood-altering substance safely again. And it sounds like that may be your situation now. If you've had problems with other chemicals, now you're using alcohol rather than the other chemicals, and you find that you're drinking more, I think it's likely that that you have a problem. And I think it would be a good idea for you to see your physician and get that checked out.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've talked to my doctor. You know, I've been diagnosed with ADD and depression and stuff like that. You know, and I'm taking medication that seems to really help with that. But you know, as far as the alcohol goes, it's like I guess I have to agree with what you're saying, because it feels like if I give one thing up, I mean, it's like I have to have something else, and I just don't know. I mean, to be honest with you, I'm kind of afraid to give alcohol up because I don't know what else. I don't know what to substitute for it anymore. You know, I've got, my self-esteem has gone up from quitting, you know, a bunch of bad habits, you know, because I've honestly kicked them. But
it's very difficult to determine for sure if you have depression, ADD, and so forth, if you're actively drinking or using other substances. So it's likely that that your medications need to be adjusted. And again, that would be something that you'd have to talk over with your regular doctor. But as a general rule, if you have other problems like ADD and depression and you're drinking a lot, that's typically not a good thing.
Bill, what do you think about maybe going to an AA meeting sometime? Just checking it out.
I do. I go to those probably once a week. And, you know, I'm seeking help through, you know, through the church and stuff. And, you know, I mean, I you know, sometimes I'll quit drinking for months on end, and then, you know, and then I'll just start back, you know, for no, you know, evident reason. But it's just something that it's kind of like it feels like a safe place. I don't know how else to put it. I know that sounds stupid, but it feels like a safe place. I don't know how else to put it.
Well, Bill, I did have a question. You said you'd quit for several months.
I mean, I've quit for 2 years before. You know, I mean, right now, I have a drink, you know, throughout the week and now. But I mean, there's been plenty of times that I've quit for 18, 24 months, you know.
Now, did you do this with assistance from Alcoholics Anonymous? You know, were you actively attending AA meetings or receiving any type of counseling?
Usually I don't go to the meetings unless I'm drinking.
Okay. Where were you as far as your depression? I mean, did it significantly improve? Because, you know, alcohol will play a major role. It's actually a depressant. And
yeah, it seems like it really doesn't affect it that much. You know, I've talked to my doctor about that, you know, about alcohol being a depressant, and I kind of, I don't know how to explain, you know, the normal reactions to different substances that most people have seem to have, you know, either a different or sometimes an opposite effect on me.
Okay. Well, I do agree with Dr. Wilson.
I don't know how to explain that. You know, when I was, I mean, honestly, when I was doing methamphetamines and coke, everybody around me seemed like they were going nuts, and it actually made me very calm. When I'm around people who drink too much, it seems like they get crazy and down in the dumps, and it makes me feel good, you know. And I you know, my biggest substance abuse problems are an issue finding people that I can relate to, you know, who are, you know, that have the same problems, because everybody that has the same substance abuse problems that I have opposite effects from, you know, from the substance abuse.
Yes, sir. You said you normally go to AA when you're drinking?
Right.
Is there something that happens, a consequence or some problem that causes you to want to go to AA?
Yeah, guilt.
Guilt?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I can tell you most people don't feel guilty about drinking if it's not a problem for them. So, you know, I would encourage you to continue to participate in AA, and you may want to go and see a counselor and definitely follow up with your physician about your drinking.
I've been seeing a therapist about it. I think there must, you know, I'm trying to find out what other issues, you know, are playing a part in my problems, but I just wanted to get your opinion about that.
Bill, thank you so much for calling. We wish you all the best, okay?
Have a great night.
We have Will from Shreveport. Will, thanks for calling Health Matters tonight.
Yes, I'm just going to pose the question and hang up just because I am driving, but I was wondering about, you know, I have alcoholism in several generations of my family, and I just kind of, if y'all have elaborated on this already, you know, I don't want to take y'all's time, but I was wondering, you know, talking about like the genetic predisposition, or it, you know, do you feel like it's more environmental, or do they play a role together, you know, as far as if a grandfather, a father, you know, is that son more susceptible?
With the hereditary portion of it, it is more likely if you have a strong family history of alcoholism, particularly multi-generational, it is more likely that you would become an alcoholic yourself. However, that doesn't mean that you're going to be an alcoholic. Just like any other genetic illness, you know, it doesn't affect 100% of the people that in the family. So I think you have to be careful. Realize that there is a higher probability, but that does not mean that you're definitely an alcoholic.
Do y'all feel like there's such thing as kind of an addictive personality?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you very much, and I'm continuing to listen.
And I think the environment is an important part. In fact, with me suffering from alcoholism, I've often worried. I have a 21-year-old daughter. Fortunately, she wasn't born when I got while I was still using. When she was born, I was 6 years sober. And I wondered about that. And of course, my daughter's environment has never been an environment where drinking was part of that environment. In fact, she grew up around me working in drug treatment centers and, participating in different support groups. And she understands, my daughter today can give you the basic 101 lecture on the disease concept of addiction. And I think it has an impact because, she's not around family members that use alcohol or other substances. She understands the negative effects that's associated with not just alcohol, but other chemicals. And as far as I know, and of course, I don't say what my child or any other child wouldn't do, but as far as I know, she's never had a drink of alcohol. And I think the environment that she lives in and she's come up in plays a factor, although she is, she has a high potential because of me to be exposed to addictive disorders.
Judy, in the family, when kids are exposed to alcohol, what is that like for them?
Well, again, I can't speak for all families because I think people have different experiences. There is a group called Adult Children of Alcoholics. I personally am not an adult child of an alcoholic. I grew up in a home where I wasn't aware of any alcoholics in my family. But I think those groups are specific to people who did grow up with the disease, and I've heard them speak before, and there seems to be a level of chaos in the family occasionally or often. And I think it's probably confusing to children because they don't know what the rules are. They don't know, mommy or daddy is a certain way when they're sober and a different way when they're drinking. And so I can imagine that would be very confusing for kids.
This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. I'm your host tonight. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. Our number for your questions or comments, it's 1-800-552-8502. Our guest tonight, Dr. Paul Wilson. He is the medical director for the Council for Alcohol and Drug Abuse, Northwest Louisiana. Mr. Bill Rose is here as well. He's the executive director. And we have the wife of a recovering alcoholic, Judy, here. Dr. Wilson, I was just reading, some of the signs and symptoms of alcoholism include not being able to limit the amount of alcohol that you drink or feel a strong need or compulsion to drink, tolerance to alcohol when you or need more to feel its effects. Those are some of the signs and symptoms that I think, people should look out for.
I agree. Those are the symptoms of what we call alcohol-dependent disorder. And basically everybody who has alcohol dependency disorder is an alcoholic. Not every alcoholic is going to have those signs, but that is common among alcoholics. It's common among really just about any type of substance abuse, having to use more and more to get the same effect, having a withdrawal syndrome when you stop. And as with a lot of other substances, for an alcoholic, that need to use alcohol will gradually take over every aspect of their life. They spend a lot of time, purchasing and procuring alcohol, hiding it from people that they don't want to find out. They spend a lot of money on legal fees and dealing with the legal system, on health issues and things like that. So it's a pervasive problem in their life as it progresses.
So they really lose control over the alcohol itself.
Yes.
In medical school, we learn the system of questioning the patients, and I will just you know, go through a couple of those questions because I think it's important for us to remember to ask these questions of individuals. And you don't have to be a physician or a healthcare provider to ask these questions. But if you're a man, do you ever have more than 5 drinks in a day? Or if you're a woman, do you ever have more than 4 drinks in a day? Do you ever need a drink to get started in the morning? Do you feel guilty about your drinking? Do you feel like you need to cut back on your drinking? Or are you annoyed when other people comment or criticize your drinking? I think we call those the cage question in training. And so those are important questions for people to consider if they themselves may think they have a problem with alcohol, or if someone that they know or love may have a problem with alcohol. Bill, what does detox look like? And let's say someone is entering treatment and they are an alcohol dependent disorder. How do they stop drinking, and what does that process look like?
Okay. Well, and I'll defer to Dr. Wilson, because he's actually the guy that wrote our detox protocol. We're primarily providing detoxification for primarily a couple of different substances. Typically, someone suffering from addictions to stimulant types of drugs like cocaine or methamphetamine, there's typically no potential for withdrawal associated with those substances, which is the same for things like marijuana. The folks that we see in detox are those that have a potential to go into withdrawals associated with alcohol, benzodiazepines, which is typically your sedative, hypnotic types of drugs. And, you know, and it depends on the insurance company whether they will approve you to approve you for detox for the benzos. And the other one is going to be those that are addicted to the narcotic pain medication. So, you know, someone calls in, you know, typically they're using within 72 hours to current on those particular drugs. Usually the withdrawal symptoms associated with the narcotic pain medication were not, theoretically, not life-threatening. They're uncomfortable, very unbearable, but they're typically not life-threatening. And Dr. Wilson can talk a little bit about the protocol that's in place to help step those folks down. But the excessive use of alcohol and benzodiazepines have the potential to have some serious risk for, you know, up to death. And there are a number of people over the years that have attempted to quit drinking on their own, you know, large quantities over long periods of time, and they slam the brakes on in their house and they go into convulsions, seizures, so on and so forth, and have literally died as a result of discontinuing those without some sort of protocol. So I don't know if, Paul, you want to talk a little bit about the either step-down process for alcohol or the benzos, and even the opiate types of drugs.
The alcohol and benzodiazepine withdrawal are very similar and are both treated with the use of actually a type of benzodiazepine on a tapering schedule. As Bill alluded to, narcotic withdrawal, I hear addicts say, you'll wish you were dead, but you won't die from it. But with alcohol, there is the possibility of it being fatal. You can have, typically when someone comes in, they have tachycardia, which is a fast heart rate, sweating, nausea, vomiting. Their blood pressure can go very high, which sometimes can lead to cardiovascular type events. And then the most serious is, as Bill was saying, is the seizures. Seizures are a component of alcohol withdrawal, and those in some cases can be life-threatening.
Now, the development of alcohol dependence, is that dependent upon a dose of alcohol? Does someone have to drink a certain amount per day, or is it somewhat dependent upon an individual's own makeup?
It depends. It's variable from one person to the other. As a general rule, though, the more you drink, the harder it's going to be for you to get off, the more difficult your detoxification is going to be.
And the detoxification basically is using a tapering, not dose of alcohol, but the tapering dose of a sedative, benzodiazepine.
Right.
So those are drugs like Valium, Ativan, things along those lines.
Right. We typically use Librium.
Okay.
But Librium. Yes, the same class.
So alcohol withdrawal can be fatal. And
yes.
You said opioid withdrawal or narcotic withdrawal tends to not be quite as severe, or you don't get seizures with that?
Typically, you don't get seizures. It has a lot of the same symptoms: nausea, chills, sweating, dysphoria, which is just basically a way of saying that you feel real bad, but typically not the life-threatening aspects that you see with alcohol.
This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Randall Brewer. The number for your questions, it's 1-800-552-8502, and this is a live show. You can call, ask questions, or make comments, and the topic tonight is alcoholism. Dr. Wilson, we did have another question that was somewhat related to the substance abuse issue, and we were talking about this before the show. Is marijuana a safe substitute for alcohol?
I don't think that I would go so far as to say marijuana is a safe substitute for alcohol. I think alcohol and marijuana can both be used safely by people who are not alcoholics. But as far as, you know, an alcoholic discontinuing alcohol and moving to marijuana, I think you get back into that issue of cross addiction that I talked about. You know, it's just not safe to use any sort of mood-altering substance.
And that need to feel something, you know, from the outside, whether it's, you know, a narcotic painkiller or a drink of alcohol or a cigarette, you know, it seems like that's a common thread among these addictions. Bill, do you see marijuana as an addictive substance in your practice?
Actually, I do. You know, the problem with marijuana is because, you know, you have those folks that have a medicinal purpose for using marijuana. You have the recreational users. And it's still considered in some places a gateway substance, especially for those that have the potential to develop substance use disorders. And we do treat individuals at CADA that their primary substance of abuse is going to be marijuana. It's typically young folks, but I think a lot of the debate around marijuana, not the political debate, because it's really about taxing, but I think the debate among recreational users is, you know, they want it legal so they can use it. But, you know, it's rare, whether we're talking about outpatient clients or residential folks, it's usually rare that you'll find a user that has one substance of abuse without abusing other drugs. You know, usually my marijuana folks are taking benzodiazepine types of substances. They're drinking alcohol on top of that. They're not, you know, if they're in our treatment program, they're not just using marijuana in most cases. You know, it may be their primary substance of abuse, but they're doing other things in addition to that. So I don't think it's safe. It's still illegal here in Louisiana, so I don't encourage it. And, you know, I'm of the school of thought, if I continue to be in possession, which puts me at risk for legal issues, to me that's abuse.
Right.
I intentionally have in my possession a substance that can cause me to get arrested. So, you know, that's a form of abuse as far as I'm concerned.
Dr. Wilson, is it known what the chronic long-term effects of marijuana are? I mean, you know, alcoholism has been well studied. We know what happens to the liver, and we know what happens to the brain. Do we have that information on marijuana, or is it just not out there yet?
I'm not aware of there being any good statistics on that as far as the long-term.
I think it'll be interesting to see where it's been legalized, you know, if they do longitudinal follow-up studies to look and see what, you know, the performance status is, you know, of individuals, and if they do tend to have more problems once access has been increased, sort of like when prohibition was lifted, you know, we could be seeing the same phenomenon with marijuana. Judy, we had a question that called in, and a caller wants to know, what are some of the examples of the things that you learned in Al-Anon that really helped you out? If you were going to, you know, give someone some advice about what can they do to take care of themselves?
Right. Well, Al-Anon taught me first to look at myself for where my behavior was out of line and had become kind of crazy while my husband was drinking. But more than that, you know, we talk a lot about boundaries in Al-Anon, setting your boundaries. And I remember the day that it dawned on me that boundaries, that my boundaries were boundaries I needed to set for myself, not for somebody else to overstep, but to keep me from doing the controlling, the manipulating, the things that I had done. So that was helpful for me to learn that. But just that focus on yourself is so important. Paul alluded earlier to the fact when someone asked that unless someone is ready for help, it's kind of hard to get them there. And so that's where I think programs like Al-Anon and from what I've heard, AA, can really help people because you find out you're not alone. Whatever your problem is, and I would say this to the woman who talked about her husband being in prison, whatever your problem is, whether it's a spouse or a sibling or a parent or a child, you're not alone. Someone else in that group has probably gone exactly through what you're going through, and nobody's going to tell you what to do, but we can all say we've been there, and you know that there is a connection there. So that helped me a lot, too.
And it seems like just going to meetings and having someone to talk to that has walked your walk is very, very helpful.
It's been helpful to me to have a sponsor who is always available to me when I have questions. I'm also a sponsor. So, you know, that helps to pass it on. But I've continued to go every week because the program has become important to me because I need to remember to keep the focus on myself, not just with my husband, but in my life.
Thank you so much. Bill, we have time for one more question, and a caller is wanting to know, in someone who has had long-term sobriety, is it okay for them to maybe try having a drink again? Maybe they've read where some of the positive effects of like say, for example, red wine on health. Is it okay to step on that slope again?
No, absolutely not.
I had a feeling that was going to be your answer. That
no,
didn't take
know,
long to.
It's kind of like telling a diabetic, you know, to now that you have your blood sugar under control, it's okay to go out and eat an entire chocolate cake. You know, it's you know, we refer to that as the waking the sleeping tiger. You know, unfortunately, those that suffer from addictions, you know, and, you know, even 27 years of sobriety, you know, you're not starting over.
Very.
You know, in a lot of cases, we've heard a number of alcoholics say that they picked up where they left off and progressed along.
Very quickly. Thank you so much. Thanks to all of you for joining us tonight. Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all your health questions, you should consult a physician or a health professional. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. The producer is Renee Moran, and production assistance tonight came from Wally Derleth and Henry Edwards. Production of Health Matters is made possible by the Noel Foundation and also by the Gables at Spring Lake Gamble Guest Care's assisted living community located behind Spring Lake Guest Care Center on Lyon Avenue in Shreveport. Learn more at gambleguestcare.com. Join us next Thursday for Health Matters. The topic will be health fads and medical misconceptions. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer.